So, my talk's entitled The Drunkard and the Guide, that's right. So, really, all I'm going to do is tell a story, which is really just a metaphor, a single metaphor for this life that we're trying to lead here on the retreat. And I'm going to tell this story, and then I'm going to explore some of the meanings of this story, and I'm going to extend the story. Really, it's just a metaphor. A story is too grand a term. It's just a single metaphor, really. And it's the metaphor of the drunkard and the guide, yeah? So some of you might have heard it before, some of you might not. So basically, the simple metaphor is this, that someone is drunk. Let's say you're drunk, or I'm drunk, and you're being led home from the pub. Yeah, that's the metaphor. You're drunk, you're being led home from the pub. The person that's leading you home from the pub is not drunk. Luckily. But you're drunk and you're being led home from the pub. And you're being led along a narrow path, muddy path, narrow muddy path, between two steep ravines. Yeah? So on the right is a sharp drop down and on the left is a sharp drop down. And you're being led home by this guide. Yeah? So that's the metaphor. It's as simple as that. So obviously what happens in this scenario is that the drunkard keeps getting annoyed by the contradictory advice. So the guide says, go right, and then says, no, go left, then go right. And you can imagine being drunk saying, you just said left, and now you're saying right, you know, make your mind up. So that's the story I want to explore. The metaphor I want to explore through the whole talk and try and show you what that's trying to say about our life, about the Dharma, about Buddhism. So first of all, you've got this metaphor of drunkenness, being drunk. Yeah, it's a really key metaphor in Buddhism that our being human, this being human, is a matter very often for most of us, much of the time, of being drunk. Of being out of our senses, of being drunk. And I was sort of playing with this in my mind. You know, when you get drunk, people act sort of more exaggeratedly in their usual way, don't they? So I remember having a girlfriend who got very aggressive when she got drunk. My oldest brother gets very affectionate when he gets drunk in a really horrible way. I remember when my sister and I were young, he came back from the pub and chased us around the house trying to hug us. It was just. I come from a small English town and that was disgusting. Nobody touched anybody. So the idea of being hugged by my oldest brother was appalling. Yeah, so you know when you're drunk, you can be affectionate in that kind of whiskey breath kind of way. You know, I've always loved you. You've only just met, you know. You either get that sort of sentimental maudlin version of drunkenness, which is quite pleasing in some ways, or you get aggressive. You sing bawdy songs, you start talking to yourself, you fall over a lot. That's a sort of metaphor. So this metaphor of drunkenness, actually, if you explore it, goes all the way through the Buddhist tradition. So when the Buddha died, he said, apamadena samparitur. So when, just before he died, his last words to all of those who'd gathered in front of him was apamadena samparitur, Pali. Obviously, he was speaking Pali because he wasn't English. apamadena samparitur. What strikes me about that little phrase, apamadena samparitur, is my own sort of little story on this, my own belief on this, is it occurs to me that this could be the one sentence that we know that's exactly what the Buddha said. People are very concerned, aren't they, with last words, even now. People are very interested in last words. You can't help thinking that last words are the deepest words. So people wait for them. And you can imagine, can't you, people waiting to hear what the Buddha's last words would be. You can imagine other people asking what were the Buddha's last words. You can imagine people repeating it again and again. So it's my own little theory, but I think it's quite possible that this is literally 2,500 years ago what the man who was born as Siddhartha, who became the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, what he said, apamardena samparita. So, that's, yeah, don't... I was going to just move on, but thank you. Anyway, so, and then... I assumed you were all Pali scholars. Got the answer. Actually, the truth is, for a moment, I couldn't remember. So it's usually translated... don't worry, folks. It's usually translated as with mindfulness, drive on. That's how it's usually translated. Apamardena, with mindfulness, samparita, strive on. With mindfulness, strive. That's how it's usually translated. It's actually not a very good translation. Apamardena is a version of apramada, which is Sanskrit. Apamardena. Pali sounds sort of more colloquial than Sanskrit. Sanskrit always sounds a bit posher. So apramada sounds a bit posher, yeah? So, don't worry, we'll get there. yeah, but what does that mean? Apra means with the least of. Yeah? Pramada means drunkenness. Yeah? Pramada, the root of the word pramada means drunkenness, intoxicity, and so on. That the metaphor is drunkenness. So what the Buddha's saying in that last thing he says is with the least amount of drunkenness, strive on. He's not saying with mindfulness of the body, strive on. He's not saying being in the moment, strive on. He's not saying... cultivate mindfulness of your body movements. He's saying, with the least degree of intoxication, with the least degree of drunkenness, and the mad behaviour that arises from drunkenness, with that attitude, strive on. Yeah? It's extremely sort of ethical term. When you get drunk, you do damage. I mean, I'm sort of ashamed to admit that I can still remember as a young man boasting of drinking and driving. You know that thing where you go to a pub and you tell all your mates at the home when you get back, I couldn't believe how I drove. I remember driving back and, just looking at the curb because I was so drunk, Actually, it's incredibly dangerous. It's, it's a disgraceful thing to do and not, but that's what the Buddha's getting at. With that, if you're drunk... you're dangerous. If you're drunk, you're dangerous to yourself. You're often dangerous to other people. You're not in control of yourself. I remember in my early retreats, I remember once coming back to London and all these drunk people in the streets. And before that, it never sort of particularly bothered me because I was one of them. although I tended to fall over very quickly, which was always very embarrassing. I remember once going to a party at art school and I got drunk before everyone arrived and sort of had to be, anyway, escorted home. But, when you get drunk, you're sort of dangerous, aren't you? You're dangerous to yourself. You're not in charge of yourself. You don't see things properly. When you're drunk, you think everybody else is, like, really stiff and boring and you're having this great time. You don't really see what a twit, can I say that? You're being, how foolish you're being, how it's actually not very funny what you're laughing at, how, and so on, you know the sort of feeling. So it's striking, isn't it, that, that this apramada, which sort of sounds, it's Sanskrit, but actually it means with the least amount of that kind of behaviour, that's, from the Buddha's perspective, that's how we seem. We seem a bit drunk. We go from, aggressive affection to railing against the world, when you start pontificating when you're drunk, railing against the state of the world, you talk out loud, you sing lewd pub songs and so on. So it's a metaphor for our human situation where we don't know the reality we're in. We're not in charge of ourselves. Yeah? Do you see what I mean? Pramada, drunkenness, yeah? So the Buddha's saying... that's the issue, is our drunkenness. Often the issue, the metaphor is used as sleep, because the metaphor of Buddha means awake, literally, awake. So that metaphor suggests that we're asleep. This is a bit more pokey as a metaphor. It's saying, no, you're not asleep, you're drunk. You're drunk in charge of, well, not in charge, yeah. So that's a metaphor of drunkenness. When you're drunk, you don't realise the danger you're in. So this man being guided home doesn't realise the danger he's in, that there's a steep ravine on one side and there's a steep ravine on the other side. He's just thinking, why does this guy keep telling me different directions? And you know, when you're drunk, you think, why are they so uptight? You know, why can't they just relax a bit? Why are they so uptight about where I'm going? I'll be fine, you know. As you fall down one ravine, I'm fine. So traditionally, when this metaphor is explored, the two ravines represent two primary views. Yeah. The view of eternalism, that you carry on in some way eternally, you're reborn in heaven or hell, or you're endlessly reincarnated. So you have eternalism on one side, and then you have nihilism on the other side, that after you die, nothing, there's absolutely nothing. There was nothing before birth and nothing after death. Yeah, annihilationism is another word for it. Yeah. Now, Buddhist thought about views is that every view that we have, I'm not absolutely always convinced about this, but anyway, let's go for it. Every view that we have, if you were to look at it deeply enough, is either an eternalistic view or it's a nihilistic view. I presume that means you have to go into it very, very deeply to realise that. But that's usually what those two slopes represent. On the right, the view of eternalism, that you're going to go on forever in some form, either literally reincarnated, it's me, but then I become Mrs. Jones and then Mr. Bloggs, whoever, you know, but it's still kind of me, but I get to wear different clothes. Kind of a little flowery thing. That's the basic idea of reincarnation. Or you think you die and at your death there's nothing, yeah? So I'm going to explore those two views a bit, but I wanted, before that, just say something, hopefully briefly, about the importance of views. Buddhism takes your views very seriously, very, very seriously indeed. To understand even that word view, it doesn't mean the opinions you happen to hold. It can mean that, but it means your deep pre-conscious assumptions about life, your place in the world, who you are, how you relate to other people. I'm writing another book at the moment, which I hope I need to finish on the 6th of January precisely. So one of the things in this book, I've wanted to try and make this whole issue of views much clearer, because I still don't think we understand how important it is. So the views we hold about something pattern the experience. How you conceptualize your experience creates your experience. Yeah? I'll come on to that. I'll try and be brief, but I'll come on to that a bit later. I just want to give you a little example of views. So remember, views aren't your conscious opinions necessarily, although they might include that. They're your deep habitual assumptions, and you pick them up from other people. You pick them up from the state, you pick them up from your parents, you pick them up from the school playground. The views you have usually are the sort of views you have with other people around you. So a little example of this. Recently I went to pick up Alex, who's my 8-year-old niece. Or I call her my niece. She's actually my boyfriend's daughter. But anyway, I'll leave you to work out the implications of that. She's a bit worried about that at the moment as well. When she was 3, I went to pick her up, and I lit her up, and she said, "Macho Bandu, you're a nothing, aren't you?" I thought we were going straight into Buddhist metaphysics at 3. So I said, "In what sense?" She said, "Well, you're not a mummy, and you're not a daddy." So I said to her, "No, I'm a friend." She said, "No." She eventually ended up with, "You're the one that Daddy talks to." Which is just about right, actually. Yeah, so this... anyway, Joe, that's a bit of backstory for you. I've got two girls in my life, little girls in my life. I'll bring them one time, hopefully. Anyway, I went to pick up Alex from school, and more recently I've been going to pick her up on my own without Gary. I used to go with Gary, but Alex asked us not to go in together because she said nobody else comes with... You know, mostly they come with mummies, they don't come with daddy, they don't come with daddy and this other bloke. About whom I don't understand. Yeah. Anyway, so I went to pick her up from school, and she's never very keen on me picking her up. Anyway, I went to pick her up from school, and she said, "Nobody knows who you are." She sort of whispered, "Nobody knows who you are." She said, I always, you know, obviously hold her hand. She said, "No, I don't hold hands anymore." And then she walked in front of me, and she said, "Nobody knows who you are." And I said, "Well, you could say I'm an uncle." She said, "I've already got three uncles." You know, like, don't be ridiculous. Nobody will believe in another uncle. You know what I mean? "I've already got three uncles." She said, "And you're not a granddad," and all that sort of thing. So she walked ahead in front of me, and then she said to me, "Everyone's looking at us. Everyone's looking at us." And I looked around, and of course nobody was looking at us. Yeah, no one's looking at us. Another time I picked her up, she went past a friend of hers and she went, "He's not my dad." This sort of really extreme stage whisper. But what struck me about it is how actually distressed she was about it. And I couldn't say, "Yeah, but what do you think?" She didn't have... It wasn't to do with what she thought. She thought what she thought other people thought. Yeah. It wasn't to do with what she thought of me. It was just that she thought what other people thought. So the views that we get, that we have, are picked up from our playground in that way. We do the sort of things that we think other people will approve of. And we hide the things that we are embarrassed by, Maitreya Bandhu in this case, or whatever. Do you see what I mean? That the views that we have are picked up from the milieu you spend time with, whether that's your guardian reading milieu, whether that's whatever it is. Yeah, they're just playgrounds, just like Alex's playground. They're a playground. And this, you see, this is another metaphor for drunkenness. Another way of saying it is that we're children in a playground who have wars with each other. And like, they had the whole thing at one time where one of Alex's friends decided that she didn't like bananas, and it spread through the whole school. Everyone suddenly thought, "Oh, bananas, like, so yucky, you know." We had to do this major banana campaign to to bring bananas back, you know, big posters. But what was striking in that example, to see how what it meant is that she wouldn't hold my hand. So, actually, she's 8 and I'm 53, so I should be all right with that. I wasn't, but I should be. But you see that what it means is that your views immediately impact on how you behave. It'll stop you holding my hand. Yeah? The view you've got will stop you holding my hand. Yeah? It's as simple as that. You don't notice that you pick them up. You don't believe that they're your views. You don't think of them as views. They are just your belief in life. She really thought everyone's looking at us. No amount of me saying no, they're not, would have helped. I could see immediately that was her experience. It has now become her view. And we're exactly like that. In many ways, we never get much older than 8. It's quite interesting being with 7 and 8-year-olds, pretty much like us. They're just less good at sort of rationalising after the event. So if I ask Alice, "Why did you do that?" She said, "Because I wanted to." Which I think is as good as you need, really. Okay, so that then sort of makes it clear why this path that we're trying to tread, we're drunk, between these two ravines, actually takes you down to two views, an eternalistic view that you carry on forever, and a nihilistic view that you are killed at life. The reason why all that's important, is because it affects your behaviour. How you think about things, how the view you have affects your behavior affects what you do. So on the right, we have the view of eternalism. As this is just a short talk, I wanted to just say that the easiest way of thinking about that is on the right, you have religion. Yeah? Simple as that. On the right, you have religion. If people ask me, is Buddhism a religion? The easiest answer is to say no. Yeah. I was really struck. Schopenhauer said that religion offered you certitude. And from on the basis of his philosophy, which was a completion and a continuation of Kant, he said that we live in a universe in which certitude is not possible. So if people offer you certitude, they're offering you a lie. It's a sham. You can't. There isn't any certitude in this universe, no. So for him, that was enough to dismiss religion. Yeah? That religion offers you certitude. This is a world in which certitude is not possible, so religion doesn't count. Yeah? So this is religion of the great sort of crevice on our right. I was brought to mind a line from Larkin's late poem, Orbade, where he said, talks of religion as being that vast, moth-eaten, musical brocade created to pretend we never die. But a brilliant summation, isn't it, of religion? That vast, moth-eaten, musical brocade created to pretend we never die. Yeah. And obviously the metaphor is that you have this beautiful brocade and you draw it across the fact of death. You hide death in religious ceremony and so on. Yeah. A brilliant sort of contraction of that. Yes, so Buddhism isn't a religion in that sense. As I said, how you think about your experience changes your experience. If you conceptualize badly, it takes you away from your life. It takes you away from experience. So just think of, for instance, in my book, I've been using that old example of witch hunts. If you believe that such a thing as a witch exists, if that's a category you have, and you see an old lady who a bit isolated acting oddly, or even acting charmingly, you can start to conceptualize around that. Do you see what I mean? I think there was something like 100,000 old women burnt and killed because of that concept. Of which, and actually relatively recently, I think the last was in 1740, something like that, very recent. It's not a medieval practice. So conceptualizing badly takes you away from reality and can cause terrible harm. You can think of the 20th century as a century of great, in this case, negatively often, ideas, communist state, communism, Maoism, and the Nazi Party and so on, yeah? You can see that how you conceptualize massively affects your life. And one of the things we're trying to understand is the import of that. Yeah? If you end up with God, you end up stuck in an abstract explanatory framework. If you end up with this sort of God delusion, you end up in an abstract explanatory framework. It takes you away from direct experience into this great big abstraction, really. Now, by saying all that, I'm not dismissing religious experience. That's a different thing. Yeah. Many people in many different religions throughout time have had very, very deep religious experiences, which I can, at my best, resonate with. We've been hearing some poems by Rumi, the Sufi master. Sometimes they speak directly into my meditation like no other thing, including, in fact, no other Buddhist poems in some way. So experience is a different thing. You can have spiritual experiences of the deepest possible category in any tradition, but how you conceptualize that either helps you further along this muddy path or it gets you locked in an abstract framework that isn't useful and that becomes distorting and limiting. Yeah. So on the right, you've got religion. Yeah. On the right, you've got religion. On the left, you've got nihilism. Going down this ravine on the left, you've got nihilism. A simple way of putting that and perhaps a more striking way of putting that now, is secularism. So if you've got religion on the right, and I'm saying that that becomes distorted, a conceptual framework, a religious conceptual framework, becomes distorting and limiting, then a secular framework also becomes distorting and limiting. So on the left you have secularism. The word secularis, the Latin, just means not about religion, you know, not to do with spiritual or religion. So you just talked about a secular building. It wasn't a religious building. It didn't have any, doesn't necessarily have any meaning apart from that. But it's become much more an ideology, hasn't it? Particularly recently, there's more and more of an ideology of secularism, which in a way is really quite odd, although in some ways understandable. But of course, the great danger of it is that it condemns you to everyday consciousness. It sort of says your everyday mind, your ordinary waking mind, the mind that makes tea and da da da. That is it. That's your mind. It suggests implicitly that that's all you can ask for from life. So the thing to do is to have a good everyday mind, which actually, frankly, a lot of us could do with, myself included. You know, relaxed, happy, in touch with yourself, non-neurotic, not polarizing with yourself, all of which would be part of your everyday mind. You know, you meet people, don't you, who are just naturally healthy and human, whether they're religious or not. Often people who aren't are more healthy and human sometimes than people that are. Just natural, healthy, human people. In a way, that's the prerequisite, is just to be an ordinary, healthy human being. I'm not sort of diminishing that. I think for many of us, and certainly when I came along, I was a real mess when I came along, and that was a high enough goal for me. Actually, it wasn't what I wanted, and I could only get there by going for something much bigger. I could never get myself motivated just to be happy. I had quite a self-destructive psyche. I still have to some degree. But the idea of just being happy didn't touch me, really. I thought, yeah, it'd be good, but it didn't really motivate me. Do you see what I mean? To be well and happy. I thought, yeah, that'd be a good thing, but I couldn't really be bothered, really. So I had to find it en route to something much bigger. So there's nothing wrong with that sort of secular, healthy, grown-up sort of state of mind. But you see, if it gradually becomes ideologized into thinking that's who you are, that your ordinary waking consciousness is who you are, and it's just not. It's really just not. And you don't need to bring any other concepts. You have to remember something like falling in love. The first time you fall in love, Freud said it was a psychosis of ordinary people, didn't he? When you fall in love, you go a bit mad. But there's this incredible explosion of images. You certainly can't make sense of it in fully secular terms. The poet Seamus Heaney, I thought, said brilliantly, he said that poetry is one art form that's never been fully secularized. It's striking that in weddings, in funerals particularly, it's poems that get read, not prose. Nobody reads something from the newspaper. People always reach for a poem. So poetry has never been fully secularized because we're not fully secularized. We can't be fully secularized. That's a myth. It doesn't exist. It's a fear-based myth, I even think. We're frightened of our depth. We're frightened of how deep this humanity runs, and we're frightened of the strange chaos of being human, the messy, strange chaos of being human. And we want to believe that we could become respectable, which is just a lie. I mean, look at your pillow talk. very, very little of your pillow talk is publishable, is it? Don't try. It's a sort of a myth that human beings can be kind of cleaned up and secular, if you see what I mean. But think of falling in love. Think of, and many of you had, certainly I've had, rapturous aesthetic experiences. You just cannot make sense of those in secular terms. I remember looking at a painting by Tintoretto of the crucifixion. Normally I don't like paintings of the crucifixion, for obvious reasons. Well, perhaps not for obvious reasons, but it is a picture of someone being tortured, and they're often horrible pictures. Not always. But I saw this painting by Tintoretto. It's a massive painting, filled almost that, you know, filled a huge wall. And I found I was in ecstasy, but it was a kind of dark ecstasy. It was an experience of the painting. Was it wonderfully acute at the pain of life, the terrible pain of life, and the possibility of something beyond that pain? None of the metaphors and images I agree with theologically, because I don't have a theology. I think I don't agree. I think they're nonsense, frankly. But the image I completely understood. I knew what Tintoretto was saying. And it struck me with a colossal force. When the art critic Ruskin saw it, he had this incredible kind of awakening just seeing this painting. He said it took him days and days to recover from it. He went outside afterwards, this is in Venice, and sat on this bench and laughed and cried. He just felt turned over by this painting. Now, people have those kind of aesthetic experiences in paintings, in the natural world, in very simple things sometimes. A friend of mine tells me about just looking at a plane going, you know, an Airbus going through the window. You pass the window and going behind a set of trees and then coming out the other side. And he said that whilst he saw that happen, there was no time and that he was completely interconnected with everything. This was just when he was in uni, just lying on his bed, looking out the window. Human life, this being human, contains those experiences. If you then think of secular, you cut all that off. You abandon those deep experiences. You even demonize them somewhat. Give them this weird word religion, which everyone gets very wonky about, which is only just a word. The word religion is trying to get a kind of world of experience that secular language isn't very good at. You know, unfortunately, the metaphor of religion is often unhelpful. So if you're not careful, we go for this liberal view. We think that the purpose of life becomes just one of liberal humanism, that let's get our governance better, let's run the country better, let's teach mindfulness for well-being so that everyone's happier, and then let's spend better, let's all kind of be better, and that'd be good, yeah? Then we'll all have flat-screen televisions, and that'd be great, you know? You see, that's where liberal humanism ends up, is that you just end up with, you know, a good world if you don't think about the so-called third world, which is they're sort of slaves, really, to this world of ours. You think that the purpose of life is just to live an ordinary human life. But to do that, you edit out your own depths. You edit out the depths of life. You've decided that they're not part of you. And that's at a great cost. Yeah, that's at great cost. This sort of nihilistic, secular, liberal humanist sort of view tends to make us assume that life isn't really going anywhere. Not really going anywhere. That we, you know, we're born and then we die, and let's make the best of it for ourselves and each other. Let's do a good job at that. And that's a good thing. But we tend to think that's all it is. Life isn't really going anywhere. What that ends up with is a philosophy of instant gratification, doesn't it? Where you're only ever a twitch of your thumb away from another thing you can buy. I remember the first time I bought a book on my Kindle. I was sitting on a balcony somewhere, and I thought, you could look at a, you know, they send a sample, don't you? You can look at a sample. I thought, well, I can look at a sample. Nothing wrong with that, you know. Anyone looks at a sample. And so I looked at a sample, and then at the end it said buy, and I just thought, oh, I bought it, you know. And there I was, straight away with the book. I didn't have to go to a bookshop. Incredible thing, really. So we have this world of instant gratification, and in that world, where for us at the moment at least, and this might horribly change sometime soon, but for us, for most of us, we can just buy stuff. When we get uncomfortable, when we get bored, we can just kind of buy stuff, and then we feel a bit brighter for a bit, and then we start to feel uncomfortable and bored again, and we can just buy stuff again, then it goes down, we can carry on doing that. In that atmosphere, you see, it's difficult to believe that life has a larger moral purpose. It's difficult to believe that life is going somewhere. because it's so easy to buy stuff. It's difficult to have a life, particularly that you need to make effort. I mean, all the effort you need to make do is flex your thumb, and everything will come to you. So it's very, very difficult to believe that moral effort, particularly the effort to love others, the effort to be patient, the effort to tell the truth, the effort to plumb your depths and not demonize them, that effort is worthwhile. Because somewhere you think, yeah, but then we die and there's nothing. So effort doesn't really add up to much, yeah? So do you see that both of these views affect your behaviour and affect your whole vision of life? That you think on the right, I think it's interesting that I think religion would have to be on the right, with its political overtones, that there's security, there's certitude, I'll be fine, but you're just going to fall down a ravine. Yeah? There is no certitude. On the left, you have liberal humanism, nihilism, and so on, which makes you think that life isn't really going anywhere, that there isn't a path to tread, a path from less to more. So just whilst I'm saying what basically Buddhism isn't, so I'm saying it's not a religion, at least that's a simple way of saying it, it's not secular either, and that both of those are limiting and distorting ideas. But I also don't think it's spiritual whilst we're on the subject. It's just the word that we can use at the moment. It's a current parlance. I've never been very keen on it. Slightly worried that something else is falling from the shrine, but no, it's not. It is an interactive shrine. So the, for me, the metaphor of spiritual easily feels over-earnest, exotic, rather precious, often humorless, and actually quite often slightly sanctimonious. For me, that's where that metaphor goes. People who say they're spiritual, I want to run a mile. So when I'm a very spiritual person, I go, oh my God, danger, danger, stranger danger, stranger danger, disappear under the table. But I don't do that because I'm a good Buddhist, so I go, what do you mean by that? So I'd rather like to get rid of that term as well, whilst we're getting rid of terms. So it's not Buddhism is not religion, it's not secular, it's not spiritual. I want to just say it's something else. I'd rather leave it at that. You could say it's the Dharma, but that's another word. I think I just want to say it's something else. Dot, dot, dot. It's something else. To find out what that something else is, you have to practice it. You have to throw yourself into it. You can't find out you can't find out what it is like to be in the water sitting on the edge. You need to sort of jump in. It's something else. It's not religion. It's not secular. It's not spiritual. It's something else. It's a new thing in Western culture, particularly. It's a wholly new thing that's still now gradually coming into focus. Yeah. So it's really something else, yeah? Okay, so there we have. We've got a muddy path between two steep ends. You've got religion on one side, spiritual on one side. You've got secular, you've got liberal humanism on the other side. This path, the story is exquisite. It's exquisitely correct. The great thing about metaphor is they're very often more accurate than argument. So that the path is literally above and between those two ravines. Do you see what I mean? Marvellously imagined. So it's not that the path is just in the middle of it, it's above and between those. So it's beyond that polarization between religion and secular. It's above that, yeah, and between those things. It's something else in a heightened sense. That's what the metaphor is saying. It's on a different level than those things. Yeah, it's something else at a different level than those things. Yeah? So obviously you're being, in this case, you're being guided. You're being guided home. You're drunk. And that drunkenness is our being human most of the time. That's our ordinary consciousness. We go from good moods to bad moods. We go from to loving people to hating them. We go to wanting things to feeling we haven't got enough and so on. Yeah, that's our drunkenness. The reason that that's our drunkenness is because, well, I came up with kind of three reasons. We don't realize the predicament we're in. That's really the metaphor of drunkenness. We don't realise the predicament we're in. And our predicament is very dangerous and very strange. So it's strange, firstly, if you just think for a moment about the fact you were born. Even that's strange. So you were born, I was born. You didn't choose to be born. You didn't think, where do I fancy? would I have chosen Warwickshire? You know, you don't choose to be born. You're born, and you're born with parents that you didn't choose.
Yes.
Who may be... Shout of assent goes from the back. Yes! And your parents may or may not be fitted to the task of being parents. They also didn't choose to be born, and their parents may or may not be fitted to the task of being parents. You're born in a particular place with all its historical forces and counterforces. You're born into that. You actually already have a character. They think that about 50% of your character, your ordinary character, is genetic, but you don't know that, and you need to discover it. You don't know who you are. So it's very strange. You're born, you're a very particular, you're a unique person without a manual for that unique person, in a world that you don't yet understand, with all sorts of forces that you need to come to terms with and work with. Yeah, it is really strange when you think about it. You didn't choose your parents, that's strange enough. And then, of course, going on from that, you don't know the danger you're in. And, of course, the danger we're in is that we're going to die. We don't know that. One of the striking things about our team retreat is some of the people on the team saying that it was some taste of that, the horror of that, that woke them up to thinking to life, really, and has brought them eventually to here and being on the team. But mostly, we don't know that we're going to die. The worst possible thing that could happen is going to happen, and we've no idea when. We couldn't be in a more dangerous situation. That's what our drunkenness is, really, is that we're the thing that we don't want to happen to us, of everything, is going to happen. We don't know when, and we're not that bothered. We're singing, you know, Shanta, oh, oh. We're sort of railing against the world, we're getting into bad moods, we're telling off the guy, I thought you said left. You know, we've not woken up, we've not sobered up to this great fact of our life, which is the fact of our life. But the other way, slightly more metaphysically, that we're drunk is that we don't understand our predicament in a more sort of metaphysical way. Or rather, we think we do understand our predicament, but we've got it wrong. So we think of ourselves as a really existing thing, a person, a thing, really, with a consciousness, this miraculous, mysterious consciousness, in a really existing world. My metaphor for it is that our metaphor, I think, is we're like a computer in a box. We are the computer, and we're in this real box. The real box is what we call the world, and we're the computer. And then when you turn off the computer, the world continues, but the computer's not there. Bad metaphor, but you see what I mean? That we really believe that we're a really existing thing in a box called the world. And therefore, when we die, it's the most terrifying thing because the world, everything else continues, but we're erased from it. Yeah. That's our nihilistic mindset, is a computer in a box. We even think that our brain is in here somewhere, that my consciousness is locked into my mind. So the Buddha says that's a drunkenness, that is not like that at all. We're not a computer in a box. We're not a really existing thing in a stage set, you know, of a really existing world with frosty fields and trees and pheasants and out there, and we're this really existing animated computer walking around it. That's not right. We think that because we're drunk. It's not actually what's there. And actually, if you pay attention to your experience, you find it's not there. Gosh, look at time. Okay. So there we are. We're walking along this path. We're guided. I'll come to the guide in the end. We're drunk in these ways, particularly we're drunk and we don't know our situation. And still worse, we've misperceived our situation. which is why we're so frightened. We think we're in a situation that's terrifying because we think we're this really existing thing in a box. And one day, that's someone's going to destroy that little thing in the box and nothing will exist, you know, a nothingness forever. Couldn't be a more terrifying vision. But that very terrifying vision is another symptom of our drunkenness. It's just that we've misperceived, yeah? So the Buddha then taught a path. It's a narrow path. It's a muddy path. And the metaphor there is that it takes skill and ingenuity to stay on it. You can slip really easily, and you slip one side or the other. You slip towards eternalism, or you slip towards nihilism. So that path is a path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. I want to talk a little bit about that and then say a bit about the guide, and then I want to finish, hopefully, by extending the metaphor a bit, because there's another way of thinking about this metaphor. So to think of it sort of more existentially, our primal assumption is this computer in a box, not a great analogy, but I hope you see what I mean, an actor on a stage set. Take away the actor. You know, the stage set is there, but there's nothing for you forever. That's our primal assumption. We were born with that assumption. We exist as an independently fixed being. The Buddha said this is a misreading. It's not like that. It's because you're drunk. That's how it looks like when you're drunk. But the Buddha isn't drunk. Obviously, the Buddha is the guide. He can see, but it's just not like that. It's not like that at all. Yeah? But because it's like that for us, because we're drunk, we think that we really exist as a really existent thing that perdures through time, that continues through time. It's the same. So I'm the same as I was when I was 8. I still have big ears, actually. The same as I was. That basically, you're the same. You're a thing. Yeah? Because you believe that, because I believe that, out of that belief comes all kinds of negative states of mind. So if I'm a really existing self in a box, then I need to push away anything that threatens that really existing self. And I need to, I'll feel compelled to attach myself to things that make me feel more real and more existent. So to people, ideas, objects, anything that makes me feel more real, more the centre of the world. I could say more about that, but you know, you want so much to feel the centre of the world. I want to feel that very much. Out of this primal delusion, this root delusion, arises this wanting stuff to make me feel real, and it's really uncomfortable pushing away of things that threaten me in some way. And things that do start to tell me that I'm not really what I think I am, I'll want to ignore. So if things change too much, I'll want to sort of blank out, I'll want to ignore. If I'm in a meditation and I start to go a bit deeper, a part of me will want to check out. I was saying in my group, this is about the time on retreats where people quietly start to check out. They find their own way of sidestepping this deep issue of self-belief. It starts to come to the surface and feel more uncomfortable. And then you start thinking, a long walk is what I really need, or whatever it is, or even a certain kind of talk. You end up suddenly getting into a political argument or something, really just to get away from this uncomfortable, crumbly sense of self not being very stable. Because as you meditate more deeply, as you practice more deeply, you can feel that, can't you? This sort of dreaminess of self. Do I really quite exist? It's quite uncomfortable. Sometimes I go to bed and I think, was that my day? Did I experience that day? It sort of all disappears. As Marx said, all things solid melt into air. You melt into air. It's very, very, you feel that, don't you? A sort of crumbliness, airiness. Yeah. And at this stage in the retreat, you'll start to feel it a bit more, and your instinct will be just to ignore it slightly, to find a good enough way of ignoring it and still keep your pride. You won't say, I'm going to ignore that, I think. You'll just think, oh, I'm just going to linger over this conversation and miss the next meditation or whatever it is. I'm just going to go to the coffee bar because I need more space. You'll find a way, probably. So try not to. I'm not allowed to. I'm on the team. And I wouldn't anyway, I'm sure. So out of negative mental states, quite obviously becomes all kinds of ways of acting out of these negative mental states that we get into, wanting stuff, not wanting stuff. We act on that basis. We act it out, yeah, in our drunken way, and we often do that automatically without even realizing it we're doing it. We often do it habitually. One of the things that happens on retreats is you sometimes get a sting of conscience, where you, in your bigger mind that you've got now, and all of you have, you can sort of see it. In the bigger mind that you've got now, in the broader self you're starting to touch on now, from that perspective, you suddenly realize, gosh, that was really mean, what I did 2 weeks ago. Or why was I getting so bad-tempered about that? That was so trivial. You get these pangs of, oh, gosh, how silly. And it's important, I think silly is the best word. It's not bad or evil or reprehensible. It's just like really embarrassing and silly. Like you've just been silly, like an eight-year-old. Like Alex, when she gets overexcited, you just get silly, you know. So you might have started to experience that you start to see that. So you see that's what we've got. We've got a root delusion. We've got that expressed in negative states of mind. And we've got that then acted out in behaviour. So the path of ethics, meditation and wisdom works on that in the reverse way. So it's no good just talking about the fact that we haven't got a really existent self. I could give, believe it or not, a whole talk on the fact that we haven't got a really existent permanent self. I could do that in a way that's cogent, persuasive. You could all agree, yes, having thought about it, we really haven't got a really existent self, and it would make no difference whatsoever. Yeah? It would actually very often make things worse, because then you think, I'm a really spiritual person because I believe that I don't exist, you know. So talking about that you haven't got a really existent self, fixed permanent self, it makes no difference whatsoever, really. Where we work on it first is our behaviour. So you start to change your behaviour. As your behaviour starts to change, you start to notice your mental states. And you start to work on those in meditation. You start to notice your mental states in meditation, and you work on those in meditation. And then with that deepened, enriched, aestheticized, purified mind, you can start to pay attention to this great matter of self-belief. But you can't do that usefully, productively, fruitfully, with your ordinary mind. You need to change your behaviour so that you're much more generous, particularly, much more loving, much more truthful, incredible, including being honest with yourself. You need to refine and purify your mental states in meditation. And on the basis of that, you can start to see your belief in a really existing self, and still more importantly, you can let it go. So that's why the path is ethics, meditation and wisdom. You first of all look at your behaviour and work on your simple behaviour, your little meannesses, your pettinesses, your evasions. We all do that sort of stuff. Your silliness, or my silliness. Yeah. After we've worked on that, your mind, when you go to meditation, is in a better state. Charlie was saying to me that after the discussion group, he was, you know, he was obviously in a good state, and he came to meditate, and you're off. You don't need to do much then. That's really the Buddhist vision, is that you work on your mind outside of meditation. Then in meditation, all you need to do is sit and relax, and then you're... And then you go to a new world, yeah? And then with that much deeper mind, you can see how things really are. So that's the path. And it's leading us away from the pub to home, yeah? It's leading us away from the pub to home. And we're being guided by the Buddha, telling us now right, now left. It'll always seem contradictory. Actually, I wanted to extend it now a little bit. I want to say that actually that's a bit limited. It's more like you're with a whole group of friends and you're all on this path, and some of you are more drunk than others. Some of you are like paralytic and having to be carried. Some of you are tipsy and silly, you know, but you're all drunk, but there's a much greater variety of drunkenness, and you're all kind of trying to help each other get home, yeah? You've still got the guide, you've still got the Buddha, who isn't drunk at all, saying, no, left, folks. Oh, you know, he'd do the hand thing so they couldn't see him. He'd go in front and do the hand thing, you know, and say, everyone would quiet down. Okay, left, you know. But you see, that's much more like it. Your context, the context makes all the difference. This is what we're doing here, is trying to create that kind of context. We're all a bit drunk. Hopefully some of us are much less drunk than others. And hopefully as the days have gone on, we're all a bit less drunk. But that's what this context is. This is our playground, if you see what I mean, like Alex's playground. And this is a playground where you get to hold my hand, yeah? To extend that metaphor. In other words, we're trying to create a context that really is helping us go somewhere. Even though we're all unenlightened, even though we're all a bit drunk, together, there's enough of us to be a bit sober, enough ways to help us go broadly in the right direction. Do you see what I mean? Without that context, you'll be led by your group of, by your playground, down one ravine or another. Yeah. And then I want to finish by extending the metaphor, because sometimes this story is told in a different way. These metaphors travel through time and they change. I'm not even sure whether my way of telling it is right, if you see what I mean. A friend told it me. I don't even know where he got it from. It's a Buddhist metaphor. But I might have told, I've added to it by telling it. And that's what these things do. They gather momentum through time. They deepen through time. They change with us. Yeah. But in one telling of it, you've got, again, the narrow path. This time I think it's a river of fire and a river of ice, but basically the same metaphor. I think it's called a thin white path between a river of fire and a river of ice. Yeah. But the problem with that metaphor, as I've explained it, the one going home to the pub, is what do we mean by home? What's home? For me, that's a very potent metaphor, home. Home, you know, going home. Something E.T. comes to mind. But I did find that very touching in that. That strangely, sometimes things like that really touch on something. He wanted to go home. And that was his whole thing. He was wanted to go home. And we all sort of want to go home. We want to go home now. We want to go to that place that really... And home is a sort of archetype for safety, for love, for the hearth, for the fire of the hearth. And of course, the fire is red. So home is a metaphor for love, for safety, for being at home now. At home, in this archetypal sense, and I know it's not like that in our ordinary sense, our human sense, home is where we can just be ourselves, where we can just be ourselves. Yeah. But in this later telling of the story, it's not going home. At the other end of this path, you're being called. You're being called. Someone's calling you. A beautiful voice is calling you. You don't actually, in this metaphor, in this way of telling it, there's no metaphor of home. There's just this calling you, calling you, calling you. And you're trying to make your way. And in this story, you're being chased by murderers and robbers along this path. So they just heighten it a bit more. And of course, those murderers and robbers are misfortune, illness, death, calamity, not getting what you want, all of that stuff. They're always chasing you. And guess what? They're going to catch up with you if you're not careful. Yeah. But with fire and ice and murderers and robbers, there's this voice calling us, always calling us. You feel that voice. You feel it. It's just calling you. It's not teaching you. It's not preaching to you. It's just saying, it's just calling you in this kind of sweet, beautiful voice, this voice of home, but it's a supra home that's calling you. And hopefully by now, already you started to feel it. When you've worked on these, started to work even slightly on this path of ethics, meditation and wisdom, you soften up. You open up, and as you soften up and open up and ripen, you can sometimes feel you're being called. Even looking at the frost and the horses walking across the white fields, there's a sort of call in it. Even our son, there's a call in it. Something's calling us all the time, sweetly, beautifully calling us. Yeah. And in this version of the story, it's Amitabha that's calling us. It's the Red Buddha Amitabha. At the end of this muddy path with these terrible dangers on all sides, is this figure of love. And he's a Buddha of love. And let's not worry about these words like Buddha. It's just, he's the beloved. He loves. All he does is love, and he's calling you all the time. Yeah? He's calling you. And you can, as you move towards a path, it's not just it's always muddy and slippy. All the time, as you get closer, further along the path, this call is felt more and more. It's felt particularly between us, because we don't go on the path as a lone individual. That's another myth, and in the West a very damaging one. We go as a whole group, as a whole Sangha, as a whole community, and some of us are hearing it more and more. And I can't say what it is. Pictures try to encapsulate it. Shrines try to encapsulate it. It's that something else that we will be fully at home in. So that's our task, is to go home, is to leave the pub and to be guided home to the love of Amitabha. Thank you.